the show.
Well, hey, everyone. Welcome to this week's show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson. A very fun roundtable for you today that we kind of threw together in an impromptu fashion. I was supposed to be talking here to Skip Burzumato. And I've just got my notes all over the place. And I was going to interview him. And then I saw Andrew Hess and Martha. And I said, come on in. And we're going to turn this into a roundtable. Because I knew I could just see Martha, just things boiling inside of her during his talk this morning.
I let it out, yes.
He came at the invite of our illustrious Glenn Stanton here at Focus on the Family, who's watching us from the Eagle's Nest over here outside in the engineering room, and to do one of our lecture series that Glenn puts together, our Family Insights lecture series, which are great, a great benefit to those of us at Focus. And today's was on dating and courtship, something we occasionally talk about here at the Boundless Show. So very pleased to have you, Skip. Welcome.
Great. Thanks for having me.
He is currently at the University of Virginia and also teaches in an adjunct capacity at Bridgewater College, and is one of those kind of sociologist type dudes. Those of you who know Brad Wilcox, who's been on our show before, works very closely with him. Mm-hmm. And we just saw a clip this morning, in fact, of Brad on Anderson Cooper on his daytime show. So you all need to go and Google that and pull up that clip. Very insightful. I'm very sorry that it involved a woman from North Dakota, because that state is close to my heart, but I can't get into that right now. So anyway, I thought those people were like level-headed out there, you know, but apparently it's the oil boom. It's just sent them all. Who knows what's happening to them now? But anyway, let's go ahead and launch right into this, because you said several things this morning, Skip, when you presented to us that some things are things that we've discussed on Boundless. And certainly I would say most of our listeners know the difference between dating and courtship and kind of have their own opinions on each. And, you know, we have the very conservative crowd, a lot who come from a homeschooling background, who are like courtship only. Mm-hmm. And then we have others of us who grew up just in the random dating vortex and have tried to climb out of it ever since. But ways to do both of those things well. But the first thing that I want to talk about is actually one of the last things you talked about in your talk this morning. And that was when I asked the question about the responsibility of the church. And you mm-hmm. talked about your background really in youth ministry and what you've seen. When you kind of realized the young adults that youth ministry has churned out in the past couple of decades, kind of what, can you comment on that just a little bit?
Yeah, I've kind of had this double career for the last 20 some odd years of, I did youth ministry for a lot of years in megachurch, kind of your traditional megachurch youth ministry, and spoke at youth conferences and put on retreats, things like that, and was involved with some of my local parachurch youth ministries. But I've also taught college, and now I am exclusively in the academy and get to know my students. I like to have personal relationships with my students and really get to know them. And so I've been able, especially over the last 7 to 10 years, kind of evaluate in a very critical way the work that I did as a youth minister, because here I was working with the result of my youth ministry. Mm-hmm. Many of those kids who were in youth ministry would get involved in college ministries, but on a lower level, and they're entering in as freshmen, and to see how they navigate that first semester. And it was always a good opportunity to then kind of reflect back on what did I do to prepare these kids for college? And there are some wonderful books out there on preparing your child for college, and even some friends of mine have written some really good books. But what has the church done day in and day out from cradle to high school graduation in terms of family ministry, not just what was going on in the youth group on Wednesday night or Sunday night, not what was going on the mission trips, but what has the church done top to bottom, from pastor to committees to parents, and we'll talk about parents in a minute, to ready the child for, I mean, we push them out of a C-130 sometimes with a faulty parachute, mm-hmm. and we send them to college, mm-hmm. and I realized I did a pretty bad job. Mm-hmm. I had thousands and thousands of kids come through my youth ministry, and I wasn't preparing them for what they were going to encounter in the classroom, in the fraternity and sorority house, in the student quad, and in just those, you know, impromptu parties that begin on Thursday night.
Yeah. I mean, I would say it even more starkly. I would say just like a big nothing. I mean, I grew up in the 80s and 90s in youth group. And I know the assumption of the parents, you know, most of my peers' parents was, let's just put our kids in youth group and that's going to churn them out as solid believers in Christ. And it just, what it did was it separated them from their family. They weren't seeing their faith reflected at home, maybe in their within their family. Yet they were supposed to go to these retreats and camps and have these amazing mountaintop experiences and somehow be changed. But then when they came back home, and the rubber hit the road, it was just back to the same old,
We didn't do a good job of giving them daily rituals, daily routines to internalize their faith, but also to live out their faith in a community. Mm-hmm. It was a very personal relationship. If it was a Christian church, it was a very strong relationship with Jesus Christ personally, mm-hmm. but no way to navigate the world. And then what has been done in the past in terms of readying students for what they're going to encounter in the classroom, you know, it might be some 1970s or 80s book on apologetics, you know, and it's yeah. like, well, you just need to tell your professor, you know, you're violating the law of non-contradiction, and suddenly their PhD is just going to crumble, and it doesn't happen. Yeah. Christian students go in the classroom and get crushed because they assume that this person's an adversary, and they just want to win an argument, and it's very difficult to win an argument.
Well, and in the realm of dating and courtship, you're kind of in the shark tank here with us because you are the married guy in the room with three of us, Andrew, Martha, and I, who managed to, you know, shockingly, make it past our 20s and still be single. So, you know, two 30-somethings here and me having hit 40 now. And so we're kind of like, you know, I'm sure we've had those moments in our life where we're kind of like, what happened? And you two were both in the lecture this morning. And what kind of top of mind kind of struck you as far as what Skip said?
Yeah, I resonated with a lot of the things that Skip said. And just, I mean, I came through, you know, a youth group like that where there were a lot of things that and the thing that I saw, and this is kind of just across the board or even personally, was in youth group, it was very much my parents' faith is still my faith. Like, people mostly associated their faith with what their parents believed. And it wasn't until I went to college that all of a sudden, this is now my faith. And people are now pushing against what I believe. And I don't know what it is, but it seems like that first year of college, most students come to a realization, I don't have to agree with my parents. You meet people that don't agree with their parents. And all of a sudden, it's you find out what was my faith really all about.
Well, and oftentimes it's just lame. I mean, you realize, oh my goodness, I'm 18, 19 years old, and I don't even know what I believe, which is why we have all these challenges with apologetics.
There is this natural time of testing your parents' beliefs, especially in that freshman, sophomore, really the sophomore year, because sophomore means wise fool, you know, and that is the year where you're jettisoning, really testing your parents. And doubting, and by that second semester junior year, usually you're reconnecting with your parents' belief if it was transmitted well.
I guess I don't reflect on my life much of like, wow, what went wrong. I mean, I grew up in a great Christian family. I went to a Christian school, went to a Christian college. I now work in a Christian ministry. Honestly, I've done a great job just staying in my little bubble, and it's been nice and safe and warm. So, I mean, I guess as I was hearing things today, I was just like, wow, I've been saved from a lot, really, of just the madness that is happening in our dating culture, just in our world right now.
Well, and what I think is interesting, I want to talk about this a little bit, is Skip, you talked in the front end this morning about how courtship moved to dating, and now they're kind of both, you know, in the same pool, and how, you know, everyone's going to understand when I say, you know, any Jane Austen novel, you know, that they gathered in the parlor and had to do chit chat, and they went to balls, and they had to, you know, and then you moved into dating, and you talked about, especially in the 20th century and World War II, and how it became kind of this one-upmanship of who you could attract and what that looked like, and then going steady and all this kind of stuff. And yeah, okay, so 200 years ago, whatever, there was no need for women to go out hunting with guys or guys to sit around and eat tea cakes with women other than the purpose. I mean, the purpose was to find a spouse for, you know, for procreation as well as for social stability and security for the women and whatnot. So it was very well understood. But now there are so many options for everyone. It's kind of like women can be single forever and support themselves and stuff. You know, what are you guys seeing as far as what was said about that? And do you think that that's affected kind of where we are in our perceptions of dating and courtship and getting to marriage?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that kind of jumps out to my mind is you think about, you spoke about cohabitation and how the thing that is mind-boggling is a lot of the research is showing that when people cohabit, it actually increases the likelihood of them eventually getting divorced, and it actually is not going to be helpful in future marriages statistically. But that's the very thing, that's the reason people cohabit. A lot of people, I mean, I've written a little bit on cohabitation for Boundless, and a lot of people push back, well, I mean, don't you want to try things out before you get married? And it really is this, they're thinking, I'm going to protect my marriage from divorce. And the way they're getting there is actually increasing the likelihood of it.
Back to a point that Lisa made, you know, we had the rise of the entertainment culture. So courtship and dating move outside of the family parlor and move into the entertainment world. And that's kind of, you know, some well-documented cultural history. What's interesting to look at second wave feminism, not first wave feminism, but second wave feminism, and to see women became more important in the workplace, more important, pursued higher education. We also see this confusion in courtship and dating. And I don't think, you know, we certainly haven't recovered from that. I think Kay Heimowitz in her new book, Manning Up, has done just some of the best work. And even if you didn't want to read the whole book, Manning Up, she did an article for the Daily Beast. Kay Heimowitz, talking about this book. And
we also did a show with her. So,
okay. So you had Kay. Okay, great. Well, you know that this gender conflict, and if you look at some of the blogs being started by guys who are just tired of women because they're so confused. It's like, you competed with us on the soccer field when we were kids. You compete with us in the classroom. You compete with us on the battlefield now. But then you want us to open the door for you and pay for dinner. What? We don't know when we're supposed to be in what role. And Kay unpacks this in the Daily Beast article, and she probably talked to you about it. I think that this culturally in our history, this is really, it's been great for women to have these opportunities, but it's also really affected male-female relationships.
Yeah.
And everybody's a little confused as to what their role is and what they're supposed to be doing.
Well, what I thought was interesting, and this is kind of where I want to get some feedback from all of you as well, is, you know, when we talked about coming out of the 20s and 30s and then World War II and then the 50s, it's very easy for us to picture. Anyone who's seen Grease, the movie, knows, you know, that whole Letterman jacket and ring and this whole going steady business and whatever. But still, even though there was more of a dating construct then, people still moved toward marriage, and they still married relatively young comparatively to now. So where are we now? Why is there this madness that we're talking about? Because when, if you talk to boomers, you know, we have one on our team, we were just talking about this morning, and she's like, it was just expected of me to get, you know, I got an education, but I was expected to get married, and I did, and I was fine with that, and I raised a family and whatever. But now it's just like no one knows what they're supposed to expect.
Yeah. If you were to ask parents going to your average evangelical church or conservative Catholic church or Orthodox church and ask parents, you know, what's your hope for the education of your daughter or your son? And they'll say, well, I went to this college and I really would like for them to go to X. And you know, where would you like them to live? Oh, it'd be so nice if they would live close by. When do you want them to get married? Not too soon. That is, every time I talk to parents, not too soon, not too early is usually the first or second thing out of their mouth. And so someone who does research on marriage, I like to ask, well, when? Well, especially for daughters, mm-hmm. you know, she needs to get her education and figure out where she's going in life. Because the young adults today, they're so immature. Mm-hmm. I don't know why we keep saying that. Every generation of parents calls the young adults, they're so immature. Mm-hmm. It's like, no, they're not. They're exactly how you are. But,
yeah.
Yeah, and so we don't have, parents don't have a script for their child. Mm-hmm. They have a script for their education, where they would like to see their child enter into the class system. I'd like for my child to be, you know, middle class, get a good job coming out of college, all those things we're worrying about in our culture right now. I would like for them to get married. I want to be a grandmother. I want to be a grandfather. But we have no script mm-hmm. for that. And I think that's a real failing.
Mm-hmm. And Lisa, you've talked before, you know, of just expect it to happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, no script then.
Yeah.
It's just supposed to happen.
Yeah.
Right. So. Well, because that's the way it does happen in the movies. You know, it's yeah. like you're just doing, you're living, you're working your high powered job. You're out, you know, you're not even interested in men. You're just out with your girlfriends, kind of the Sex and the City model.
That's right.
But then this guy stumbles into your sphere and he's so amazing that he breaks the barrier and wins your heart, you know, and whatever. And we think that that's going to be our story. And then we realize, no, we're dealing with a bunch of guys who are passive and women who are controlled. And none of us are normal. We're all just messed up because of whatever. And so, yeah, we're upset that we didn't get the story we wanted.
And let me head off some comments that you'll get to my comments. I'll head them off at the pass because mm-hmm. I know, because I get it all the time from parents and young adults post-college or even late college. They say, well, we can't script marriage because we don't know. It requires two people. We might want to be married, but we just don't know when someone is going to come mm-hmm. into our lives.
Well, that's 95% of the women that listen to the show are going to say that. Yeah.
And
isn't
what
that
I would.
True?
Yeah, I know.
That's not true.
What's that?
That's not true.
It is true.
Okay.
It is true, but there's nothing wrong with wanting to be married and even signaling that mm-hmm. earlier. Mm-hmm. You know, you okay. wait until you're out of college, you wait until you're out of grad school. It's hard to signal mm-hmm. because who are you signaling to?
Right. Right.
You know, college is the best place to find someone to marry. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, we've all been to college and we know mm-hmm. thinking back now, boy, that was the last time I had the luxury of a whole cohort of people like me, mm-hmm. similar background, similar education, obviously.
I would say, I mean, yes, there were a lot of numbers, but the guys, I mean, you kind of want a guy to have a job, to know where he's headed in life. Like, I don't know.
Why?
Say, I mean, lots. Why?
Why?
Security.
Security yeah. for what? I mean, you're not, what are you going to go live under a bridge? Everybody talks about getting all these things in line. Make sure the guy has a job. Make sure he's got a good major. You know, let's stay away from the philosophy majors, all right? And my son is one. He's going to be a senior, you know, but let's stay away from the philosophy, the English major. Let's stay away from the guy who just likes to go camping on weekends, all that. He might have great character. He might be a real godly guy, but he just doesn't seem serious enough about life. I'm holding up quotes now. Mm-hmm. Whatever mm-hmm. the heck that is. Mm-hmm. And so we start writing people off without, because we have in our mind this Sex and the City metropolitan life. I'm not saying you did, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. but this is my response back. It's like, mm-hmm. no, there probably were. Let me cut myself off.
Well, there are different expectations that people have. Martha wants security. Martha wants a guy who has his stuff together. I yep. want like excitement and like super intelligence and all this. We all mm-hmm. have these unrealistic whatever. So, you know, I think that's definitely part of it. But Andrew, any closing thoughts for us?
Yeah. And one of the things that I think is slowing a lot of guys up is, you know, you go 50, 100 years ago, and if you weren't married or pursuing marriage, you were lonely.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, you know, there was a lot of loneliness there. It was like there was this natural inclination to, I need to go find a wife so that I have a companion, so I have somebody to eat with. Now I see a lot of guys, and they're, you know, you talked about the rise of entertainment, mm-hmm. where there's guys who live very full lives who aren't dating somebody, But, you know, whether it's education or just even just doing stuff with other guys or with community, mm-hmm. where we kind of joke around about the blob, where there's all these Christian friends. We always hang out together, but nobody's matching up.
Right.
And I think in some ways, there are guys who are replacing the drive for marriage with, I'm getting all my needs satisfied with my friends. And maybe not sexually, but mm-hmm. they feel companionship in ways that maybe they didn't years ago.
And just as a closing thought for me, I think we have a lot of work to do with mm-hmm. young guys. Mm-hmm. I think men of my age and younger, I'm 47, so I think my generation and the half generation below, we need to be grabbing these guys in college and jacking them up mm-hmm. and putting them up against the wall saying, wash that Cheeto dust off your finger, forget about playing some sixth grader in Des Moines online mm-hmm. gaming and getting the high score. Mm-hmm. High score will mean nothing. Mm-hmm. It's time. Mm-hmm. And the adult life is an exciting life and it's a fun life, yeah. but it's time.
Cool. Well, that is all. Speaking of time, that's all the time we have for today. Andrew, I will say, he's legit. He's got his stuff together. Although, because we're friends on Facebook, I see all these exciting things that he's doing with his group of friends. And so we're going to tell him he needs to ditch them so that he's going to create this, you know, vacuum of loneliness in his life. Because he's always out at some ball game or eating out with friends or hiking.
It's true.
So
I'm describing
we're
myself
call,
there, actually.
We're going to call him.
We need
to get Andrew lonely, people. That's going to be our next goal here at Boundless. So, well, thank you all so much. I want to call attention to a two-part article series that Skip has done for us at Boundless called A Brief History of Courtship and Dating in America. So check it out on our site, and you can get the full scoop behind what he talked about. And then you can write to us at editor@boundless.org and agree or disagree or get all crazy. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.
This is what hope feels like. Breathing in brand new life. The breath of your lungs. Bringing us back to love. Oh, Jesus. You
Well, hey everyone, I am here for another culture segment, and I know a lot of you guys are fans of these because you get introduced to just neat people out there who are trusting the Lord in their circumstances and are learning great things and sharing great things with us, and today's interview is no exception. I have got Larissa Murphy on the phone with me. Larissa, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Oh, very good, except we're in the middle of these fires here in Colorado Springs, and so we're just trying to put up with that, with the smoke, but we're hanging in there.
Good.
Well, we've known about you here at Boundless for a little while. I was talking to you before we started taping about the book This Momentary Marriage by John Piper, and how I have a friend here at Focus who gave it away as a favor for her wedding. She and her husband did. And this book has played a good part in your story as well. I'll start off by saying that for anyone who probably has followed, some people have followed Larissa's story with her husband, Ian. And it just kind of came up, surfaced again on the Desiring God site, as well as Justin Taylor's site and other people who have kind of been following you through your blog, prayforian.com. And we want to talk to you a little bit about your story today because, you know, not that we want to put you on a pedestal or say, you know, oh my goodness, you're just superhuman or anything of that nature, but you have a story that really is a testament to God's goodness, and we want to talk about that a little bit today. So what I want to start by asking you, Larissa, and hopefully, you know, we'll reveal kind of some of your story as we talk here. But just as an overview, why don't you kind of just give us in a nutshell what the story is as far as you and Ian, and then we're going to talk about a couple of the particulars.
Sure. Ian and I met when we were in college. We were both attending a state university out here in Western PA. And one point, we were in the same major, and I ended up switching. But we actually met on the college TV station. I was an anchor, and I think he was a cameraman at the time. And then we actually ended up having some mutual friends that we didn't realize until we ended up at somebody's apartment all together. And from there, we just kind of grew in our friendship, and Ian really took an interest in my spiritual life. I was a very new believer, and so he kind of reached out to me and was inviting me to his church where his dad was pastoring at the time. And so from the very beginning, he was just a very faithful friend in that way. And after getting to know each other for a couple of months, we started dating in November of 2005. Which was, I guess that was our third year of school. And then we spent the summer apart on internships, and we were scheduled to graduate in December of 2006. And then in September, he was in a car accident and suffered a traumatic brain injury. And nothing has been normal since then. He was in a hospital, in a few different hospitals in Pittsburgh for about 7 months, and then came home in the spring of 2007. And we just fought through therapy and discouraging doctor's reports. And at the time, Ian wasn't able to talk, and he regained his speech about a year and a half or 2 years later. And then in 2010... we decided, well, actually it was 2009 when he proposed, we decided to get married because we had, I'd kind of, as we were talking to his parents and our pastors about it, just said that Ian needed to be able to communicate with me in order to make a marriage happen. And so once he started talking, it became more of a reality, and we were married on August 28th of 2010.
Wow. And it's been quite a journey since then, from what I've gathered from your blog and elsewhere.
Yeah, it's been very interesting. I mean, as far as even just Ian's condition, you know, typical brain injury, the doctors will say about 3 to 5 years, you'll get back what you'll get back. But we know so little about the brain still that it's just a mystery to doctors, and there's no guarantee. And Ian is now in his sixth year past his brain injury, but really a lot of his progress has come in later years. So, you know, even from the very beginning, God has just been very clearly healing Ian, and seems interesting in the ways he's doing it. It's not leaving any room for us to think that it's just medicine or doctors alone that's doing it, but a very clearly God's work. And then, you know, on top of a very difficult situation in August of, I guess it would have been 2009, his dad, who was incredibly involved in our lives, was diagnosed with brain cancer, and he passed away that October. So definitely been, we've seen affliction in the past 6 years and have just kind of had to experience a lot of sorrows, but we're really just excited that we were able to get to the point where marriage truly was an option.
And that's a lot to experience. I mean, you are both still in your 20s, aren't you?
Yeah, we're both still 27. Yeah. We were 20, I think, when we met, and Ian was 21 when he had his accident.
Wow. Okay. So what, and I want to back up a little bit here in a minute, but tell us then practically, just so we have an understanding of this, what does this practically mean for you day to day? Like, what does your day to day life and schedule look like? Because I know you've talked about this on your blog a little bit, just how, you know, you're responsible now for, you know, providing and just different things. You know, what does this look like for you?
It's very weird, but I think it's also very normal all at the same time. It's like this weird paradox of a very strange life, but also what we go through is very normal, too. We've been just really blessed with, we have great agencies here that help us with Ian's care. So Ian does, has the option of having full-time staff with him. So we have a caregiver that spends each day with him while I'm at work. I work full-time at a bank. And then his brother and his mom are able to work for him, too. So it's just a huge blessing because we have family members who are able to help him and spend time with him so that I can go grocery shopping or do whatever, or just help him, you know, with transfers and out of bed or into his wheelchair. So I work all day, come home and get to see Ian. Evenings, I think, are pretty normal. We eat dinner. We try to have quiet times, hang out with our friends and family. So, yeah, I think there are those things that are very weird in that I am the sole provider, and unless God does something pretty significant, Ian will not be able to work. So, mm-hmm. you know, I knew that signing on to, I knew what I was signing on to, a full-time career by yeah. marrying Ian, which, you know, was just a cost, but wasn't anything that made me too scared to do it.
Sure. So let's talk a little bit, Larissa, about your worldview of marriage, because it really was shaped from the beginning, even pre-accident. And like you said, you know, you talked about Piper's book and really how you understood that marriage has a larger purpose in this. Talk a little bit about how you lived that out, you know, from the very beginning.
Sure. Well, since I was a fairly new Christian when I met Ian, he taught me a lot about just how to protect each other's hearts when you're dating. And he was just, his dad raised his boys. There are four boys total in Ian's family. His dad just raised them to be very intentional in the sense of just encouraging them to not pursue a relationship until they were in a position that marriage was an option. Not out of a sense of legalism, but just wanting to care for young women's hearts and, you know, not totally give themselves over to relationships, all the emotional hardships and commitments that would come from that until they were actually in a position where they could commit themselves and their life to that woman. So that was new for me, and it was wonderful because it just brought on a totally new picture of how God would be caring for us through that, and just Ian's desire to protect my heart and care for me. So from the very beginning, it was intentional. Our first date, he said that he wasn't dating just to date around, but he was looking at this very intentionally to see if God would have marriage for us. So from the get-go, that's what we were looking for and praying about.
So, Larissa, you say that even though you chose marriage in light of the situation, you chose it sadly. Can you talk to us a little bit about this and then really about your thought process immediately after the accident as it pertained to kind of where do we go from here? I mean, how did you wrestle with that reality and then ultimately decide to marry despite the circumstances?
Mm-hmm. One of the things that really held me was that what Ian demonstrated to me before his accident was that he was such a faithful friend to me and brother in the Lord. And I knew that if the roles had been reversed, Ian would not have left me. And so that carried me a lot throughout the time when he was in the hospital and he was unconscious. You know, he wasn't able to really give us signs that he could hear us. He couldn't talk. And I would just sit by his bed and talk to him or read him his Bible and just remember thinking constantly that Ian wouldn't leave me. He wouldn't give up on me. He wouldn't just walk out. And not that that would be wrong. I don't think it would have been wrong for us to stop dating. But we decided to stay together and we decided to, you know, once Ian was communicating and God would give me little glimpses. His heart rate on the monitor would go really high when I went in, or, you know, all of the people working with him would just say, he looks at you differently. And I couldn't really see it, but I was being told that all the time. And so because of the character that I knew of Ian and just also the big view of God that we've been taught, knowing that God is bigger than our marriage. And so even though we knew it would come with a lot of costs and, you know, to get back to your original question of choosing it sadly, we just have a lot of sadness in our lives. There's a daily sorrow and there's daily grief with living with a brain injury. I think it's probably one of the hardest disabilities to have to live with because we are almost living with two versions of Ian because we have Ian before the accident and we have Ian now. So there's a lot of sadness and sadness over losing Ian's dad. And we knew that our marriage wasn't going to be what we had pictured it to be 6 years ago. I knew that Ian wouldn't be able to necessarily plan a date for me or surprise me with flowers. So there was a lot of sadness in that, and just sadness seeing Ian at our wedding not being totally healed, but also knew that God would be faithful to us, and that we were able to just display Christ's love by being committed to each other, even in the midst of really difficult circumstances.
Hmm. And you say, too, that even though, you know, there are many practical things, many things that Ian is incapable of because of the brain injury, he is still a leader in your home in some ways. And can you talk about that a little bit? Just, you know, what submission looks like in your marriage and what his leadership looks like?
Sure. I think that's been one of the biggest lessons for me, and was one of the hardest things adjusting to, because when we first got married, and I say that as if we've been married forever, we've only been married for, it'll be 2 years in August, but the transition into marriage, probably like any quote-unquote normal situation, is hard, and found myself angry at Ian a lot, and so much of it was, I was just really upset at his brain injury and upset at the things he couldn't do, the practical things, even though I don't even know why I had that expectation, because I knew going into it he couldn't do it, but there was still an element of grief there. And so those practical things he's not able to do, but when I look at what he is able to do and what he brings to our marriage, it's what is most required and is what is essential, and that Ian loves me so well, and he loves, I think, better than anyone I know who's has all of their abilities, and he's constantly patient with me. He is very quick to point me to truth. He's just caring for my soul, and he's able to pray for us. He's able to point me to Christ and point me to heaven when I'm struggling with something, or when I'm struggling with condemnation. He's so quick to point me to the very basic truths about who God is, and that's what I need. That's what I need as his wife, and that equips me to better serve him too.
Mm-hmm. So what would you say, in light of that, what in your marriage have you realized really has come to the forefront? Like, what is most important? Maybe some of the things that you had thought were important at one point aren't as much anymore, and other things are more so.
I really don't think it's important to have my house clean. I say that, half jokingly, but, one of the things I learned too is that there's only so much I can do in a day, and that I need to be prioritizing our spiritual well-being and just enjoying Ian. It's really easy to get distracted by all the practical things because I'm the one responsible for all of them. And so it'd be really easy for me to fill all of my evenings with things that are necessary, but some can be cut out, and I need to be seeking to enjoy my husband and for us to enjoy God together. And so one of the things that's taken me a long time to learn, and I'll keep learning, is just prioritizing in that way and recognizing, that Ian's needs need to be taken care of emotionally and spiritually just as much as his practical needs. And that if the kitchen is a mess when we go to bed, that's okay.
Yeah. So what do you two do for fun?
Well, it's summertime now, so we go swimming a lot. We have a public pool here where we go as often as possible. We spend a lot of time with his family. His family lives here in the same town as us. We sit on our porch all summer. We pretty much live outside all summer, try to read together, and just really exist, which is what it was like even before Ian's accident. We weren't a super active couple. It's not like we went hiking and kayaking. We just sat around and talked and laughed. So that's very similar to what we do now.
Mm-hmm. That's neat. Well, I think, Larissa, there are a lot of people that are listening, who are probably maybe dating someone, or maybe they're engaged, or maybe they're just hoping for marriage someday. And they hear your story, and for them, it's just, it's even impossible to grasp. I mean, it's really something that they can't put themselves in your shoes at all. But there are many elements to your story. And just like you said, the day-to-day stuff, things that you have to do, things that you're doing as a wife, you're working, you are, you know, relating to your husband in a way that, you know, is biblical, and learning how to do that and coming to grips with your own sin and how that plays out. What would you say, kind of as we close here, Larissa, what can young adults who hope to marry someday really learn from your story? I mean, bring it into their situation. If you could make sure that they take one thing away, just from your experience, what you're learning, how you're walking through it now 2 years in, what would you want them to take away?
Well, I think one of the things that was pressed on my heart the most, right as we were going into our marriage just a few weeks before, was what a friend had said to us who had just spent many years caring for his wife who passed away from cancer. He just said to me that you will never regret loving this much. And I think for young couples or young adults who are single and praying for a spouse, just knowing that when two Christians who love the Lord first are looking to pursue a marriage, go for it. If you are in love with the Lord and love this person romantically, God is going to be so faithful to your marriage. And I think, not to say in a way that scares anyone, but a lot of people could face a significant trial and will face a significant trial within their marriage. The only difference is that we're starting there. And to be able to see marriage as a reflection of Christ loving the church and trying to keep that in the forefront of your mind, that this isn't just about roles or, you know, who does what in the marriage, but we have an opportunity to show Christ to the world by loving each other and serving each other and being tender with each other. There are so many marriages that just don't get to experience that joy of the way that God has designed marriage to be. And so I think when we have an opportunity to show that to the world, we should do it anxiously, but also just praying constantly, knowing that each day we need oodles and oodles of grace to get through it. But, you know, just as there will be many times of many valleys, there will also be so many peaks, because marriage is a good thing, and God has designed it for us to enjoy and to bring Him glory. So it should be just prized really highly and seen as just a beautiful gift from God.
That's good. And I love how you, I mean, not only how you said, you know, there's not a lot different really when you look at the essentials, not a lot different in your story other than that you're starting out kind of with that trial, with that hard place. But I love how what you're saying really indicates that it's not something that you're letting overshadow your marriage. You're recognizing that your marriage has a bigger purpose and that it has a bigger timeline really than what can be constrained by illness. And that's so true. And I think that there's, you know, just the evidences that you have of how, you know, living life there in that town and with Ian's family and what you're doing. And just there's so much to be taken from that. I think that's great. Larissa, thank you so much for talking with us today. For those of you out there who want to follow Larissa and Ian's story, you can do so again at prayforian.com. And that is where Larissa blogs and just shares photos and anecdotes and kind of some of the day-to-day things that are truly an encouragement to those of us who are anticipating marriage someday and kind of walking the path toward that right now. So Larissa, thanks so much for just sharing from your heart and really sharing a lot of wisdom that you are gleaning now in your 20s through what God has you walking through during this momentary marriage and beyond. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Lisa.
Rescue me.
Well, hey, everyone. We're going to open up this week's inbox. And, of course, we have the famous Candace Waters with us. Candace, hey.
Lisa, I don't know how famous, but I am glad to be with you today on my birthday.
You are famous, and it is your birthday week, so we're very excited.
My birthday week.
And Steve's birthday week. You have to share it with him.
That's right. Most people just get a day, but I want a week.
Yeah. Well, happy birthday to you from everyone here at Boundless who loves you and loves your advice that you give us and all of that. So very, very fun to have you on board.
I was thrilled. This is like my birthday present today.
I know. Well, and what better way to celebrate your birthday than to talk about marrying a virgin? So that's what most people think of.
More appropriate
exactly.
subject, right?
Yeah, and just the various things that that entails. So,
okay.
So let me go ahead and read
Bring
this.
It on, Lisa.
Read this question. You can weigh in. Okay, so this listener says, I'm a 31-year-old virgin, and one of my desires is to marry a fellow virgin. But the older I get, the more I wonder if that's an unreasonable desire. I plan to remain a virgin until married, but should I even bother keeping that as one of my criteria for whomever I marry?
Well, I think that it is statistically unlikely, and it's important to be aware of just the nature of the landscape of the single population. And I'm speaking of believers. So one study showed that 70% of fundamentalist Christians, self-described fundamentalist Christians, believe that premarital sex is always wrong. And in that same survey, 69% of the respondents admitted to having premarital sex in the last year. Hmm. So when you do the math, you realize that there is an increasing shortage of believers who are waiting to have sex after marriage. But because something is statistically unlikely doesn't mean that it's impossible. And certainly we serve a God who is perfectly holy and calls his believers to be holy, and by the Holy Spirit's power gives us the ability to obey him. And that obedience flows out of our love for him. Christ said, if you love me, you will obey me. So I would not ever tell anyone to stop hoping for that. And I certainly wouldn't say, hey, just cross it off your list, because I think if you do that, your temptation is to let your own guard down and think, well, if I can't get a virgin, why should I even bother to be a virgin? Hmm. And again, our motivation for purity must always be to see the Lord. Scripture says, the pure in heart shall see God. That needs to be at the forefront of our minds, and that is such a powerful aid to us when we face temptation. I love how Dr. Russell Moore says that after puberty, we're all sexually broken. And it's because we're all fallen. And the temptation for someone who has managed to remain pure in this area of sexual intercourse can be, I think, prone to pride and to thinking, because I haven't had sex per se, I am not only a technical virgin, but I am pure. And anyone who isn't or who hasn't waited is impure. And I think those are just the wrong categories. We all stumble in many ways, and we're all fallen and in need of God's grace and mercy and the blood of Christ to forgive us. So if you bring that understanding that we're all broken to your relationship, I think you come to it with a much greater sense of humility. And then if you find out that the man that you are in love with and hoping to marry has had a sexual past, you, I think, have the ability and are much more inclined to be able to forgive him.
Yeah.
And so I think you have to be prepared for the possibility and statistically the probability that the person you marry may have some baggage. Okay, so we know that, and it's kind of like the World War II generation, the young women who wanted to get married, a lot of them thought, I may likely marry a man who's missing a limb. That was just the nature of the landscape. You had all of these young GIs coming back who had been, in war, and a lot of them had injuries and had sustained injuries that they then had to live with for the rest of their lives. I think in our day and age, the warfare is a lot more relational and sexual, and especially with the Internet, you have a lot of sexual shrapnel and people walking around limping because of sin in this area. So the question isn't then, have you sinned, but how have you dealt with it? Have you seen it for what it is and repented and turned from it, and are you crucifying it in your life? Are you waging war against it? Or do you have this sort of attitude of, well, everybody does it, and it's a temptation, and man, isn't that awful? But then you kind of, give yourself a pass to keep sinning. I think that is a key issue for anybody in a dating relationship asking if they should marry is, how is this person overcoming and winning? You know, how are they having victory in this area of their life?
Yeah. Well, those are good thoughts. Candace Waters, everyone, weighing in on that question. Thank you so much, Candace.
You're so welcome.
Okay, everyone, write to us at editor@boundless.org. If you have not received an answer to a question that you think you have, certainly go on our site and search for anything that you might have as a question, because it's very possible that we've addressed it in the past. But questions like these are ones that we receive from you and want to make sure that we get our folks to weigh in on them. So until we answer the next question, that is it for this week's show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson, for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of boundless.org, focus on the family. We'll be right back.